hard to please. It calls any moral method unpractical, when it has just called any practical method immoral. But St. Francis was neither fanatical nor unpractical. The whole meaning of his message is that mysticism makes a man cheerful and humane. The whole point of his point of view was that it looked out freshly upon a fresh world, a world that might have been made that morning.
Even in the modern world, St. Francis of Assisi is one of the most popular and admired of the saints. He's also one of the most difficult and most misunderstood. But there was one modern writer who understood him very well, G.K. Chesterton. Hello, I'm Dale Alquist, and welcome to The Apostle of Common Sense, a series of programs where we explore the words and wisdom of the great English writer G.K. Chesterton. In 1924, less than 2 years after his conversion to Catholicism, G.K. Chesterton wrote a book on St. Francis of Assisi. Chesterton was always attracted to St. Francis. In fact, one of his earliest essays, published over 20 years earlier, long before his conversion, was an appreciation of St. Francis. Indeed, he says that St. Francis stands on a bridge connecting the early part of Chesterton's life with the life that he experienced after his conversion. He says, "Francis was never a stranger to me." In this wonderful book, Chesterton describes St. Francis first as a soldier and a fighter, then as a builder and a reformer, then a jester, a clown of God, a troubadour, and a poet. Then as a beggar who embraced poverty as other men embrace wealth. A little poor man who embraced not only all men as his brothers, but all creatures, great and small. And finally, Chesterton describes Francis as a mirror of Christ, one who truly reflected the light of truth. It may seem strange to think of St. Francis of Assisi as a soldier, but that was what he first wanted to be. There was nothing dishonorable about it. On the contrary, it was an act of chivalry. He was a patriot, and he believed in defending his own city of Assisi. He rode off to battle in a war with Perugia, and expected to return a hero and a prince. But he was captured, and instead of a prince, he was a prisoner. Francis resolved to keep up the spirits of his fellow captives. He seems to have liked everybody, especially those whom everybody disliked him for liking. In fact, says Chesterton, it might have been while he was a prisoner that he heard the first whisper of that wild blessing that later took a form of blasphemy. He listens to those to whom God himself will not listen. He vowed never to refuse to help a poor man. His life, says Chesterton, was one riot of rash vows, that turned out right.
Francis returned from war a dismal and disappointed and perhaps even derided figure. It was his first descent into a dark ravine that is called the Valley of Humiliation. He was also very much puzzled and bewildered. One day he was riding listlessly in some wayside place when he saw a figure coming toward him. It was a leper. At that moment he knew instantly that his courage was being challenged. What he saw was his fear coming toward him. The fear that comes from within, and not without. Then he sprang from his horse, rushed on the leper, and threw his arms around him. He gave that man what money he could and rode on. We do not know how far he rode, but it is said that when he looked back, he could see no figure on the road.
Next comes the great break in the life of Francis of Assisi, the point at which something happened to him that Chesterton says must remain greatly dark to most of us, we who are ordinary and selfish men whom God has not broken to make anew. There was an old shrine in Assisi, the Church of St. Damian, which was neglected and falling to pieces. During the dark and aimless days following the tragic collapse of his military ambitions, Francis was in the habit of praying before a crucifix at St. Damien. One day, he heard a voice saying to him, "Francis, seest thou not that my house is in ruins? Go and restore it for me."
Francis sprang and went. He sold his own horse and several bales of his father's cloth, making the sign of the cross over them to indicate their pious and charitable destination. His father did not see things in this light. He put his son under lock and key as a vulgar thief. This was Francis's blackest moment. The whole world was turned over and was on top of him. The bishop told Francis that he must return the money to his father, that no blessing could follow a good work done by unjust methods. Francis not only did that, but he returned to his father the very clothes he was wearing, save a hair shirt. He then went out half naked into the winter woods, walking the frozen ground, a man without a father. Penniless and parentless, he burst suddenly into song as he walked under the frosty trees. Only then did he realize that the way to build a church is not to pay for it, certainly not with somebody else's money. Instead, the way to build a church is to build it. So he went about collecting stones. He went about as a new sort of beggar, reversing the parable of the beggar who asks for bread and not a stone. The very queerness of the request gave it a sort of popularity. He then worked with his own hands to rebuild the church. But he was laboring at a double task in that he was rebuilding his life as well. The adoration of Christ had been part of his nature for a long time, but the limitation of Christ began here.
Chesterton says that men like Francis are not common in any age, nor are they to be fully understood merely by the exercise of common sense. But what Francis did by way of imitating Christ and having others join him in that effort was common sense. The spectacle of a ragged young man begging for his building materials as well as begging for his bread does not sound progressive or practical at all. In fact, it seems a very dubious enterprise. What were the practical and progressive results of changing clothes with a beggar? How could such a simple act have any real effect on the world? But the fact is, Francis was able to bring about reform in the church without a revolution. The reforms may have been drastic, but they were actually practical, because they touched something common in men of faith.
Francis got hold of the rough brown tunic of a peasant and picked up a rope at random and tied it about his waist. 10 years later, this makeshift costume was the uniform of 5,000 men. And 100 years later, men in that costume laid the great Dante in his grave.
To St. Francis of Assisi, religion was not a thing like a theory, but a thing like a love affair. He was a romantic. He was a lover of God, and really and truly a lover of all men and a lover of creation. He was a troubadour, and he spoke the true language of the troubadour when he said that he had taken on a most glorious and gracious lady, and that her name was Poverty. But beyond being a troubadour, he was a jester, a clown of God. He was at once someone who was earnest and solemn, and someone who provided comic relief. He knew how to be a fool for Christ. He became that fool for Christ after a period of solitude and literal darkness. He entered a cave to be alone with God. Chesterton says that the man who went into that cave was not the same man who came out again. He emerged into the light with a lightness, with the lightness of humility, and he saw the world in a completely different light.
In that capacity, he saw the world upside down. He perhaps saw the world as St. Peter saw it, when he was crucified head downwards. And what did he see? In a cynical sense, men have said, "Blessed is he that expecteth nothing, for he shall not be disappointed." The newly enthusiastic Francis now said, "Blessed is he who expecteth nothing, for he shall enjoy everything." It was by this deliberate idea of starting from zero that Francis came to enjoy even earthly things, as few people have ever enjoyed them. He is akin to the mystic who passes through the moment when he is aware that there is nothing but God, who beholds the beginningless beginnings, at which point there was really nothing else. At that moment, he not only appreciates everything, but also the nothing of which everything was made. The result is a simultaneous sense of great gratitude and sublime dependence. I should think that the worst moment for the atheist comes when he is really thankful, and yet has nobody to thank. St. Francis emerged from his worst moment. He emerged from that cave, having discovered how much he had to be thankful for, and having made that discovery of an infinite debt, he paradoxically found himself transported in joy. This, you see, is the key to grasping Franciscan asceticism. It is the highest and holiest of paradoxes that the man who really knows he cannot pay his debt will be forever paying it. He will be forever giving back what he cannot be expected to give back. He will always be throwing things away into a bottomless pit of unfathomable thanks.
The modern world tends to think of asceticism as something terribly gloomy. Not so, says Chesterton. In fact, if there's one point that he tries to make about Francis, it is that he was an ascetic, but he was not gloomy. He was the court jester who grasped the truth of this riddle, that the whole world has only one good thing, a bad debt. As soon as Francis had his vision, in which he saw our total dependence on divine love, he flung himself into fasting and vigil exactly as he had flung himself furiously into battle.
He devoured fasting as a man devours food. He plunged after poverty as men have dug madly for gold. And it is precisely this passionate quality of his personality that is such a challenge to the modern mind and its fixation on the pursuit of pleasure. For it is undeniable that Francis was a happy man as he went about trying to prove that he had nothing.
Chesterton calls Francis a poet whose whole life was a poem. In fact, he was perhaps the one happy poet among all the unhappy poets of the world. He made the very act of living an art, though it was an unpremeditated art. St. Francis was also perpetually preoccupied with the idea of brotherhood. Not a back-slapping sort of brotherhood, but a brotherhood actually founded on courtesy. He honored all men. That is, he not only loved them, he respected them. He saw the image of God multiplied, but never monotonous. There was never a man who looked into Francis's eyes without being certain that Francis was truly interested in him. He was a genuine democrat in the true meaning of the word. He treated the whole mob of men as a mob of kings. Of course, Francis is famous not only for the kinship he felt with every person, but with every fellow creature. His love of nature, however, is perhaps the most misunderstood thing about him. He did not worship nature, which, as Chesterton points out, is an unnatural thing to do. He worshiped the Creator. His love for God was expressed in the charity he showed to God's workmanship. He was able to see each tree as a separate and sacred thing, a brother of man and a child of God.
Francis did not call nature his mother. Instead, he called a particular donkey his brother, and a particular sparrow his sister. This is where his mysticism is so close to the common sense of a child. You see, a child has no difficulty understanding that God made the dog and the cat. That child also understands that the making of dogs and cats out of nothing is a mysterious process. But no child would understand if you mixed up the dog and the cat into something else and called it nature.
His attitude towards the created world, as towards everything else, was indeed mystical. Chesterton says St. Francis was a mystic, but a mystic who believed in mysticism, not in mystification. He was the mortal enemy of all our modern mystics who melt away the edges of things and dissolve everything into everything else. His vision was very clear, very distinct. He was a mystic of the daylight and the darkness, but not of the twilight. But he was not just a mystic. He was a builder as well. Francis went with 11 companions in peasant costume to ask Pope Innocent III to create a new religious order. Monastic orders had already been approved by the Church. It was clearly understood that vows of celibacy and poverty free a person for a life devoted to prayer and service. Francis, however, did not call his little brothers monks, but friars. A friar is not only freer than an ordinary man, he is also freer than a monk. It was important that he should be free from the world, but it was also necessary that he should be free from the cloister.
The whole point of the monk was that his economic affairs were settled for good. He knew where he would get his supper, though it was a very plain supper. But the whole point of a friar was that he did not know where he would get his supper. In fact, there was always the possibility that he might get no supper. There was nothing that the world could hold them by, for the world catches most of us by the fringes of our garments, by the futile externals of our lives. This should give us a glimpse of the practical side of that aestheticism which puzzles those who think themselves to be practical. You could not threaten to starve a man who was ever striving to fast. You could not reduce a man to beggary who was already a beggar.
The Church had to look closely at what Francis was proposing. The Church is always on the watch against excessive asceticism and its potential evils. But, says Chesterton, the Vatican decided that while these Franciscans might have a hard life, it was a life described as ideal in the Gospel. Now, many of the followers of St. Francis treated him as the founder of a new religion. As Chesterton says, the coming of St. Francis was like the birth of a child in a dark house, lifting its doom. The Franciscan spirit brought a certain freshness to all the world, and a freshness to the Church as well, for the Church at this time was over 1,000 years old and was feeling its age. The freshness and freedom of the first Christians seemed as lost and as far away then as much as it does now. The Church certainly needed the renewal that Francis brought. But there was a real danger that that sweeping movement of Francis would sweep up all of Christendom. The Pope understood that as great as Francis was, it was not necessary that every Christian should become like Francis. The Pope rightly determined that Franciscans would have a specific role within the Church, not that they would take over the whole Church. Chesterton says that if the Franciscan movement had turned into a new religion, it would have been a narrow religion, something less than the universal Church. As for Francis himself, he may have seemed wild and romantic, but he always hung on to reason. He never lost his balance. That is because he never lost his sense of humor. He was always in the light of Christ. He was a mirror of Christ, as the moon is a mirror of the sun. He was the mirror of Christ because he was truly an imitator of Christ. He was most inspired by that part of Christ which the rest of us most avoid, his suffering. Chesterton says Francis was full of the sentiment that he had not suffered enough to be worthy even to be a distant follower of his suffering God. He did not feel he was worthy even of the shadow of a crown of thorns. But apparently, he was worthy. Francis, the mirror of Christ, even bore on his body the wounds of Christ. He was a man who suffered, but he was a man who was endlessly cheerful. A soldier, but a man of peace. A builder, but a beggar. A wise man, but a fool for Christ. A mystic, but a man of action. How do we sum him up? Chesterton says that Francis was above all a great giver, but he cared chiefly for the best kind of giving, which is called thanksgiving. He understood the theory of thanks and knew that its depths are a bottomless abyss. He knew that the praise of God stands on its strongest ground when it stands on nothing. I'm Dale Ahlquist. Join us again on The Apostle of Common Sense.